The first oral argument case for the new year is William John Keck versus the State of Nevada, case number 79815. Are you ready to go, Mr. Oram?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm ready to proceed.
Okay, and Mr. Pesci, you also ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, you can proceed, Mr. Oram.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Oram. I'm the appointed attorney for Mr. William Keck. Mr. Keck should receive a new trial and or a new penalty phase based upon several assignments of error. The first I'll start out with was there was an indication that Mr. Keck had changed his medication through the VA approximately 3 weeks prior to this homicide. He was prescribed Theracule. During closing argument, the defense counsel made the argument to the jury that maybe Theracule had some form of involvement, may have affected Mr. Keck. And to actually quote what counsel said, he said, "Did Theracule cause him to do it? I don't know. Could it contribute? Maybe." Clearly, defense counsel at that time had no ammunition other than just pure speculation that perhaps Theracule had caused this. We were appointed an expert, Dr. Antonuccio, who is pretty much the foremost expert on this subject. He actually testified before the FDA on these type of matters. He's a Stanford graduate, both from undergrad and PhD. He spent his career, as he testified, trying to educate people on the effects of these drugs. What Dr. Antonuccio concluded was that it was possible that Theracule had an effect, but unlikely. He couldn't say it was likely, and I think that adds to his credibility, that what he said is, look, I'm looking back in the future at this. I'm looking at all the studies, and what I'm saying is it's possible that this affected him, but he could not say likely. I asked him on the witness stand, do you think this would have been informative to a jury? He said, absolutely. What this jury was not given was the understanding of the Paxil results, the Paxil studies, which showed that approximately double the amount of individuals would have a violent or aggressive reaction once given Paxil. So out of 300 or so people, you're going to get an extra violent or aggressive behavior from a patient. Now, this is information that needed to be presented to the jury so that the jury could adequately make a determination whether this in fact mitigates the punishment of death. And considering defense counsel was simply trying to argue that maybe it had an effect but absolutely no ammunition. And so that issue combined also with the fact that defense presents mental health considerations by a Dr. Reedy, I think I'm saying his name correctly, and unfortunately, this doctor presented information about Mr. Keck's mental health, but then he began to tell information that was very, very prejudicial to the defendant. He said that the defendant had necrophilia fantasies, that he had seen or had images in his mind of a female who had had the death incision in ice, having gone through an autopsy, and he would like to have sex with her. And this was what the defense was presenting, that he threw his wife's cat off a balcony, thought it was funny, that he was bleaching the bones of a chinchilla he would paint with blood and semen. He enjoyed blowing up things. This was presented by the defense, not by the state. And the state's argument is, well, this was done to mitigate because it was presenting mental health evidence. Well, that's not true. It's just inflammatory. It hurt the defendant badly. And I cited to Buck versus Davis for the proposition that there should be reversal if the defense is presenting evidence that is harming the defendant. And in Buck, they presented evidence that there was future dangerousness based on race. And what the U.S. Supreme Court noted right in the syllabus, that when damaging evidence is introduced by a defendant's own attorney, it is the nature of admission against interest more likely to be taken at face value. The reason I say that is because that's what happened here. The jury undoubtedly looked at what had been presented, and it was very damaging to Mr. Keck. And so as I look at both of those arguments put together, we have a situation where, one, very damaging evidence is presented by the defense. Two, there is no evidence about Seroquel whatsoever. There was no toxicologist that was consulted. Additionally,
Mr. Orm? Hi, Justice Kadish, how are you doing today? Good to see you.
Good to see you, Your Honor.
I have a couple questions. First, about the Seroquel. Given that the foremost expert that you were able to retain on this petition came in and testified that it was possible but unlikely that it contributed to the act that brought Mr. Keck before the court, how would that be of assistance in his mitigation, given that he's going to get on the stand and say it's unlikely? Isn't that going to get used against the defense?
No, I don't think so, because based on what his testimony was, how can anybody tell? Nobody can really tell whether Seroquel contributed. And so he was just being as fair as he could be. He kept saying, I can't say anything more than possible. But he gave four examples of why he thought it was possible that this had happened. And one was the Paxil studies. Two was the combination of the drugs, Seroquel, Paxil, and Xanax. And that he noticed that the threats to Mr. Keck's wife occurred or appeared to him to occur after he began taking Seroquel. And lastly, Mr. Keck began describing issues of akinesia without any prompting. And so he thought it was possible. And, you know, Your Honor, I agree that it's possible, and I would like probable, and I would like likely, and I don't have that. But what I do have is a doctor who would say that, who's the foremost doctor. He's testified in front of the FDA. And I could go to a jury and say, spare his life, because he's one of the people it did affect. And that's something of interest to a jury, and it's for the jury to decide.
So it's my understanding that there are some studies about Paxil having this possible effect. And it's my understanding Mr. Keck had been taking Paxil for quite a lengthy period of time, unlike the Seroquel. Are there studies that show, peer-reviewed studies that indicate Seroquel leading to this type of a violent event?
No, and he made it clear there are not. And he said that the similarities between Paxil and Seroquel he thought were significant. In other words, he thought it had the same effect. He did point out that there are no studies. However, he did say specifically that in Canada, they have warning symbols on or warning signs on this warning of violent and aggressive behavior, which we do not have in the United States. And quite frankly, he said that the manufacturers, the drug companies, hate this kind of study. They hate the fact that there are studies coming out showing this information. And so what we have is we have that kind of information. And then I would argue that's for a jury to decide. You know, jurors should be given as much information as they can to make a determination whether somebody should live or die. And if one out of 300 people in the studies on Paxil are having aggressive behavior and he sees a similarity between Paxil and Seroquel, then that information, I would argue, should have been presented. And so that, as I see it, is a serious difficulty in this particular case.
And let me ask you, one more thing. About the mental health information, the testimony by Dr. Reedy. So I guess, how do you think he should have approached it? He's getting on the stand for the purpose of testifying about the mental illness that Mr. Keck was suffering from. But he should talk about his conclusions without talking about what types of things and information he got from Mr. Keck that led him to reach these conclusions?
Yes. In fact, this is a subject that's come up many, many, many times in my career on capital cases, and that is we send mitigation experts out or specialists out to find out information. A lot of times in a capital case, you will find out very damaging information about your client. This is not something you're supposed to be presenting. And so I have ways of making sure that that does not go to another expert. In other words, once you find out that, let's say, one of your mitigation witnesses says that your client raped the family cat, obviously, you don't want that information given to the state. You need to keep that from them. We don't have a duty to present harmful evidence against the defendant, against their own client. So what they could have done easily is had somebody get up there and testify to what his mental health problems are without mentioning that he likes to paint with blood and how he likes to paint chinchillas and throw cats off. It was just no point.
Their testimony that they, you know, effectively that it was a strategic type call to rebut the state's position that he was faking it, for lack of a better term. How would you address that?
I would address that. That's exactly what the state argued in Buck. They argued to the United States Supreme Court that why they put forth the doctor, their expert, was because he was going to provide mitigation, essentially a lack of dangerousness. But in doing so, they then present evidence about race, and that because the gentleman was African American, he was more likely to commit crime in the future. And the Supreme Court rejected that. They said you can't do that. So there are ways to put a psychologist on the witness stand to just present the evidence of the psychological difficulties the defendant had without presenting very, very damaging information. And so that's what I would argue to the court. I also know that I only have 4.5 minutes left. I would like some for rebuttal, if that's possible.
Yes, of course, Mr. Horam, you'll have 4 minutes and 25 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Pesci, you ready to go?
Yes, thank you very much, Justices. Hope everyone's doing well. I am Giancarlo Pesci on behalf of the respondent, the state of Nevada. In response to the arguments just made, I'd like to start with Buck, and I think that it's very important to focus on the mechanism within Texas was for a condition precedent to make someone death eligible is this concept of future dangerousness. That's very foreign to me from our system. That's not the way we do that. But in Texas at the time, they had to make a determination, the jury that is, unanimously and beyond a reasonable doubt, that he would be a danger in the future. So the defense called lay witnesses, experts. One of the experts said that, among other things, there was this concept of race, this immutable characteristic, and utilized this as a means of showing or arguing that he was not a danger. Talked about these statistics that I don't know how that expert came up with, but talked about them and said he was not a danger. We do not have the defense in William Keck presenting this so-called bad evidence, the chinchillas and the seagulls being fed hot sauce. That's not to establish the condition precedent, the aggravation, that is. That's how Buck has no business being applied to this particular case. No one stood up and said that this individual was more likely to be dangerous because he's bleached the bones of chinchillas. And justices, I would ask you to look at Buck in particular. They talked about how this information was brought forth by the defense. That's why it was this ineffective assistance argument. But they noted that the prosecution cross-examined on it, that it was argued in closings, and what's more, that during deliberations, the jury in Buck asked for the expert's report. Now, justices, in this case before your honors, and I apologize, I've got to turn my head because of the computer setup here. It's volume 14, Bates stamp, 1952 to 1965. That encompasses the complete and total argument in the penalty phase by the state of Nevada and the defense. No one talks about necrophilia, chinchillas, seagulls, painting in blood, none of that. No one argues it. No one brings it up. What's more, there's not a single question from the jury. During deliberations, they didn't ask a question, didn't ask for a report. And by the way, Dr. Reedy didn't even prepare a report. Think of how effectively that was, that Dr. Reedy got on the stand and testified about the mental health issues of William Keck, never having generated a report. I think that's what Mr. Orm's talking about earlier when he says that defense counsel do different things to make sure the negative stuff doesn't come out, right? And what's interesting and what's difficult, really, I actually kind of feel for Mr. Orm and other defense attorneys, is they have to make a decision what they're going to present, what they're not going to present. And if I'm hearing him correctly, what they're saying is they should have more effectively hidden the bad stuff. And I don't know how you go about that, especially today. Today's January 4th. 13 years ago today, you all or this court issued ADKT 411, which specifically addresses the handling of death penalty cases. And this court has instructed attorneys like Mr. Orm that they're supposed to have on their team experts, that they're supposed to have medical experts, psychological experts, that provide information about the client's mental well-being to explain or lessen the client's culpability, to otherwise support a sentence less than death. And justices, I would point you to volume 14, still in that same volume, date stamp 1988. That's the special verdict form in this case. There is only one checked. The only one checked is defendant's mental health issues. So let's play this out for a second and assume for the sake of argument that Mr. Kane and Mr. Banks followed what Mr. Oram is saying and they did not present Dr. Reedy. How would they even get this? Isn't it the fact that it's so important that this court came up with ADKT, acknowledging that juries want to hear from doctors and psychologists, that they need to do that? And they did it, and they were successful in finding at least one, and it could have been all 12, who said that there was mental health issues with this particular individual. Notwithstanding those problems, they still came back with the verdict that they did. And Justice Kadish, you hit on a point that I wanted to make, which is, how is that going to be beneficial for if we were to use Dr. Antonuccio and for him to come in and say, it's possible, but not likely? See, as is, that is with Dr. Reedy, it's possible. If they call Dr. Antonuccio, it's not likely. What do you think the prosecution is going to do on cross-examination of Dr. Antonuccio on not likely? What do you think is going to be done in closing arguments about not likely? Moreover, if this individual were called, which is what they're saying, it was ineffective assistance to not call him or someone like unto him, he's going to say that there's, and I'm probably mispronouncing this, this akathisia, which is an extreme agitation or mania. Don't you foresee, justices, having sat through, having actually some prosecuted these cases, the prosecution going through all the underlying facts of this case that are in direct contradiction with the extreme agitation? See, because Mr. Keck, after he takes a chainsaw to a door and an AK-47 21 times through the door, decides by pointing the gun at the security guard to tell him, I wouldn't do that as far as intervening and not shooting him. Then getting in his car in this alleged extreme agitation and mania and driving to his home, getting out, somewhere along the way hiding an AK-47. That's a little tricky. It's not really a handgun. And the police searched for it and couldn't find it. Getting to his house and then taking off his clothes, you know, the ones that he could be identified in, and putting them in the washer and the dryer. And then in the midst of this extreme agitation and mania, got in bed with his girlfriend. I think, as Justice Kadish said, that wouldn't have been a lot of help. And under the Strickland standard, can we really say that the outcome would have been different if that had been done? And I don't think that they could do that. And speaking about the ammunition, Mr. Oram talked about how they had no ammunition because they didn't use Mr. Antonuccio. You know, it was Ed Kane in closing who said the following, and this is in, I think it's volume 12, it's 1706. Mr. Kane, do we punish someone with a brain abnormality the way we would punish someone without a brain abnormality that commits these crimes? Mr. Kane, do we punish someone with mental illness the same way as we punish someone without a mental illness who commits these horrible crimes? Do we punish someone who is on antipsychotic medications the same as we punish someone who is not on antipsychotic medication who commits these crimes? That omission included the reference to the antipsychotic medications, where it was still in the possible range. If Antonuccio hits the stand, it's not likely. I don't see how it's likely that this outcome is different had that happened. And I don't understand, honestly, how it is that Mr. Reedy hits the stand without admitting the truth. The necrophilia, the seagulls getting the hot sauce, how do we hide the truth? Is that what we're really saying? They're supposed to be more adept at keeping back the evidence? And I understand they have duties to their clients, but I don't understand how a witness is supposed to hit the stand and not give the information that they actually obtained. A witness that this court has said, a type of witness, the defense in a capital case should use to try to help get the very thing that they did in this case, which was at least one juror to come back with a mitigator. I mean, the other mitigators were not even contested and they didn't even check them. That he served in the United States Navy wasn't checked. That his father had a stroke and subsequent illness wasn't checked. We didn't even argue against that. but they did find a mental illness. These defense attorneys did an appropriate job, and this should not be overturned, and I would submit it. But there are no questions.
Mr. Pesci?
Yes, sir.
Hi. Good to see you as well. I have a question about another issue we haven't talked about yet today, which is these two well-trained defense attorneys, which is why they're on a death penalty trial. We all know that. But to have not made the Batson challenge before the jurors were dismissed, what should we do with that, and isn't that ineffective?
So in response to that, Justice, in direct appeal, this court addressed that issue not directly in the context of an ineffective assistance, but looked at it and talked about the overall strength of evidence in this case. And so as it was untimely, based on this court's direct appeal decision, we understand that's the status. That being said, when it actually occurred, the court had the parties make their arguments. And so, as I understand it, appellant's asking for an evidentiary hearing, or there should have been an evidentiary hearing on this. I don't understand what's that going to do, because the court, that is Judge Herndon at the time, took all of that evidence, heard all that evidence of the arguments from the defense and from the state, and then made his findings based on that. So while it is untimely, it was actually still preserved and fleshed out. And I think I ran out of time.
Nope.
Oh, no, that's just the 5-minute warning. Sorry. So that has already been preserved, and the court has the opportunity to go through that. And when you look at what it was that the court found, there's no reason to have a new hearing. And more importantly, nothing would have been different if, in fact, it had been timely instead of untimely, because we know what, in fact, happened.
Thank you.
Do any justices have any questions for Mr. Pesci?
All right. This is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas, and I do. I want to circle back to the question of the testimony that was introduced about the chinchillas and necrophilia and so on through Dr. Reedy. What justification? There was an evidentiary hearing on the PC as to whether that was incompetence of counsel to put that forward. And I'm trying to understand what the justification for it was. As I understand it, it was that the state was arguing that he was feigning mental illness and it was not legitimate. But I get a suggestion from your argument that they needed to call a mental health expert. And once they called him, it was wise to elicit everything, no matter how horrible, that the defendant had said, that formed a part of the basis for the expert's opinion. What was the record at the trial court level on that in the PC?
Justice, if you give me just 1 minute, I'll try to find the exact wording. But my recollection was that Mr. Kane testified in the PC hearing specifically to say that he knew that there was very damaging evidence, the underlying facts of this actual murder case and attempted murder case and the killing of an unborn quick child, that he needed something to try to bolster the argument of mental illness. And so those rather strange or peculiar proclivities that this particular defendant had helped to make the argument, or to bolster the argument, that in fact he had mental illness. And the state would argue that the verdict form finding lets you know that that in fact was successful. And so there was a need to put forth information. To some level, it could be described as shocking in order to bolster the idea that he had this mental illness problem.
Mr. Pesci, let me ask a question.
Let me just finish up 1 second here. But the argument was not that the information would be elicited by the state on cross about the necrophilia and so forth, because you're saying there was no report, the state didn't know it, and the state's position was that he was a malingerer, feigning mental illness when he was perfectly fine.
Yes, so the malingering was the second component, as I understand it, as to why Mr. Kane utilized this particular information, is because he knew that we had information that he got himself out of the Navy by saying that he was mentally ill, had a tattoo that said Section 8, which is the terminology apparently for getting out of the military. So it was to dovetail with that information to try to bolster that idea.
Okay, but the argument wasn't that he had to put it out there because the state would have brought it out anyway.
No, no. And you know, Justices, if I could, one of the issues or one of the bad things that was put forward was that he wanted to kill. It didn't take Dr. Reedy to establish that Mr. Keck wanted to kill. The direct testimony in the guilt phase was replete with information that prior to the killing, he wanted to kill that baby that was done or was made to be there by some other man other than him. And so that wasn't some revelation that was brought forth by Dr. Reedy. Justice, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It does. And I'm sorry, Justice Silver and I were speaking over one another.
Oh, no, that's okay. Thank you. I think the point that the defense is making here is that you have somebody whose MRI medical evidence shows he's got prior brain injury, and certainly a lot of other damaging evidence showing mental illness. They're claiming that by putting in this extreme shocking, like for example, throwing or hurting an animal or necrophilia, that goes into the realm of ineffective assistance that aggravated, you know, this, it actually helped you, the state, for aggravation. What do you have to say to that?
So what I would say is it didn't help us. We didn't do anything with it. We didn't argue it. And then I would hearken back to, I'm sorry, can I keep going?
Yes, you can finish your answer, Mr. Pesci.
Thank you very much, Justice Harsley. It didn't help us. We didn't do anything with it. And hearkening back to Buck, it was not the issue. They found ineffective assistance in that context because that was the condition precedent. In order to find him death eligible, it had to be future dangerousness. The defense introduced information about future dangerousness in Buck. That was the critical issue. That's not what we have here. We have an individual who did some horrific things, and that's all put forth in the case in chief and the guilt phase. And then he has these strange proclivities, which actually can be argued that helped them put forth that mental health issue.
Are there any other questions from justices? All right, seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Pesci. Ms. Clerk, would you add a minute to Mr. Oram's reply time?
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Oram.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Mr. Banks testified at the evidentiary hearing regarding the bad information that we've been talking about. He said it was horrible. And so when I hear Mr. Pesci talk about Mr. Kane, I understand that was accurate. That's what he testified to, but the other attorney did not. He said it was horrible. Didn't know, from what I could tell, he didn't understand why it was put on. It doesn't help. And when I hear the state say somehow the defense would be covering up the truth, that's not accurate at all. I actually had a situation where a psychologist in the midst of my capital trial came up and said that one of my client's family members hoped he died. Was executed and put it in the report. We immediately had Mr. Drew Christensen from the Office of Appointed Counsel. He got us another psychologist, and we were able to present that information without the obviously the very damaging. It's not hiding. We're not prosecutors. We're not supposed to put on evidence that's harming our client. Another thing that I'd like to point out is there was no objection to that Batson JEB argument. And one thing that has caused me concern is that assuming this case went into federal court, one of the things the federal court looks at, the standard is that there has to be an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law by the state of Nevada, the state's highest court. It appears from the direct appeal that the court said, no, this was not objected to. They let the panel actually be sworn in and go. And so we're not going to consider it. And now we have a situation where there's not going to be an evidentiary hearing, and I wonder at some point when we're actually going to get to the merits of this. The public defender who wrote it did an absolutely beautiful job. It's well briefed, and it should be considered by the court. So in the event it was denied, the federal courts could hear it. And I would also like to point out what has already, the procedural history of this case and already ineffective assistance of counsel. There was a wedding argument made by the prosecution in this case. This court's majority found it was improper. However, the court's majority also found that defense counsel had made an improper argument, which sort of invited the state's improper argument. Justice Cherry found reversal in a dissent. He said it should be reversed. But this court's already said defense counsel made error there. There was a mitigation instruction that was improper. This court noted it was improper. And again, Justice Cherry said it should result in reversal. I didn't get evidentiary hearings on either one of them. This is ineffective assistance. There was no discussion of consulting with a Seroquel or a toxicologist to present the Seroquel information I brought out. The defense counsel brought out these bad acts that we have gone through. And so when I look at all of those combined, I would say to the court that this case should be reversed on ineffective assistance of counsel on not just individual arguments I've raised, but looking at it as a whole, I would argue that reversal is mandated in this particular case.
Mr. Oram, this is Chris Pickering in Las Vegas, and I have a question about the jury questionnaires and the Batson challenge. I don't see in the record on appeal from the PC hearing that the questionnaires were included in the record on appeal, but the district court's judge's order denying the post-conviction petition references that they were part of the record on the first direct appeal and gives cites to those. Am I misinformed that those questionnaires are not in the record on this appeal? And if I'm not, should that affect how we look at that issue? Or should we go to the other record on the direct appeal?
I think we can go to the other record on direct appeal because it was all briefed and the court simply just said it wasn't objected to. So where the it's in the record and the information can be sought. What my complaint on appeal is obviously I'm asking for reversal and asking the court to look at it anyway. But one of my complaints was I didn't get a chance for an evidentiary hearing to ask why didn't they object? I mean, why did they wait till the jury was impaneled? So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but it may not be
I'm not entirely. Like, what should we do with that when you're asking us to presume that there was an objection would have been helpful and they would have been able to make the case, and yet we don't have the questionnaires in part of this record, and I'm not sure what to do with that.
I would ask the court to look at the original appeal, and it's in the record there. That would be my request.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Are there any other
questions? Mr. Oram, this is Justice Hardesty. In the absence of the introduction of the bad act evidence that from defense counsel, what evidence would the jury have relied upon to find a mental health mitigator?
It would be very easy. First of all, they could have just called somebody from the VA's hospital or the VA who could come in and testify that we're prescribing Mr. All of this information, if I could be permitted to finish.
Yeah, sure. Finish your statement.
They could have called in somebody from the VA. Why are they prescribing all of these drugs? And just tell the jury what he was suffering. It would have been very easy without all the rest of these bad acts. Any psychologist could have done it. You just present the information and leaving out the bad acts and have the psychologist testify.
Okay. Are there any questions from the justices? All right, thank you, Mr. Oram, Mr. Pesci, for your arguments and brief in this case. Briefs, I appreciate it. The court does too, and the matter will stand submitted. Thank you for your